Hey, good morning, everybody. Welcome to school. Anatomy, this is Anatomy 231, and it's April 13th, and we are approaching our third exam. And take a look at the schedule. On the right-hand side, I'm going to turn a bunch of these lights down and leave that one on, just like that. Ooh, I don't like those either. Okay, so today is April 13th, Monday, and we're going to get into special senses today. And after that, we just have one more lecture, and that is endocrine system. So today and on Wednesday, I got to cover special senses and endocrine system because that's what's going to be on the next exam. All right, and your next exam is 1 week from today, April 20th. All right, so that's Monday at this time, 1 week from today. Chapters 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17. And that's just a usual exam, but that's an unusual day because you might notice that there's a P3 on that date as well. So those of you that have labs on a Monday will also have an opportunity to get course points with the practicum, the third practical exam. And in lab, I'll go over what you have to do for that, but that's pretty straightforward. All right, so the people that have a Monday lab get a lecture exam and a practicum on the same day, and the Wednesday labs get it then on the 22nd, which is the Wednesday. All right, so on the 22nd, that third practicum, about a week and a half away. Does anybody have a question on the schedule? Don't be blindsided by the fact that if you're a Monday lab, you have a lecture exam and a practicum on the same day. The material is similar, so it might be helpful. I'm not sure. Okay, so that's the schedule. Is there anything else I want to say about that? Not so much. Okay, except, got a question regarding the lecture exam. How do you prepare for the lecture exam? The study guide. That's right. Make sure you work the study guide. Because when I make up an exam, guess what I pick up? The study guide, so that I know that I'm testing you on the stuff that I'm asking you to learn. All right, so you should use it as well. All right, well, let's get into special senses. Did I have any opening comments on special senses last time? Did I say anything at all? No. Okay. Well, you know what? I got to tell you what a special sense is. First of all, what is a sense? What is what you need for a sense? You need a receptor of some kind. That's right. So if your body wants to know glucose concentration in the blood, there's got to be a glucose receptor. If your body wants to feel damaging stimulus, like a very hot temperature, you need to have thermoreceptors, right? If your body wants to be able to recognize light, what do you need? Photoreceptor. Yeah, photoreceptor is the proper term for that. All right, well, I mentioned a bunch of receptors. Some were special, some were general. So let's talk about what the difference is for just a little bit. Temperature. All right, if I take an ice cube and put it on your earlobe, can you tell me that it's cold? Would you be able to feel that cold on your earlobe? Yeah, what about on the back of your hand? Could you tell it's cold? What about your kneecap? Belly button? All right, so you can appreciate that cold or hot temperature where on your body? Pretty much everywhere, right? So if you have receptors for a particular energy, then we call that a general sense. You have to have receptors all over your body for that. What would be another example of a general sensation besides temperature?
Pressure.
Pressure, that's right. If I were to poke you on the elbow or on the shoulder, back of the head, your ear, whatever, you would be able to feel that pressure or vibration. And if I took a pin and I stuck it in various places of your body, you could, every time I did it, you would say, ouch, that's right, because you could feel that. All right, so again, those would be all general senses. Special senses are the kinds of senses that you can perceive only in one or maybe two locations in your body, and that's it. So for instance, if I take a flashlight and shine it right into your belly button, can you see it? No. Or your kneecap? No. Right in your eye? Yes. Okay, and that's the only place. Your two eyes are the only places where you can sense light, because that's where photoreceptors are. So if there's only one or two locations, we call that a special sense. So vision is what kind of sense? It's special. That's right. What are maybe some other special senses? Hearing, I like that, because you can only hear with your ears, can't hear with your fingertips. Taste, yeah, only with your tongue, again, not with your fingertips. Smell, I like that as well. So we got vision, hearing, taste, smell. That's four. Okay, and we're going to learn the special names, the scientific names for all those senses in just a little bit. And then there's two more, which are, yeah, they're out of the ordinary. I want to say special, but that wouldn't be right to say special. But they're special. They're for balance or maintaining equilibrium. And there's two of them. One, maintaining balance when you change your velocity in a linear direction. When you change your velocity, we call that acceleration. So going 55 miles an hour is not acceleration, but going from 0 to 50 is acceleration. Or going from 55 to 0, that's deceleration. So that, and in a linear sense, that would be, you have receptor organs for that. And then you also have another sense for spinning. And that's called angular acceleration. So if you spin at a constant rate, they won't tell you anything. But if you stop spinning or start spinning, that's when they will give you information so that you can maintain balance. So both of those are balance. Linear acceleration, sometimes we call that static equilibrium. And then angular acceleration or spinning, sometimes we call that dynamic equilibrium. They go by a couple of different names. Okay, so the first special sense that I want to talk about is gustation. And gustation is a fancy word for taste. All right, and of course we can taste with our tongue. And that's because our tongue has taste buds. All right, so here is a typical tongue. And you can do this little experiment at home. You can go to a mirror and stick your tongue out, and you see some that the surface of your tongue is not completely flat and smooth. It's kind of velvety because there are things sticking up off of the tongue. Do you think those things might be taste buds that you can see with your naked eye? Okay. Well, we can see that there are some in different locations, like on the tip of your tongue. Some of these we call fungiform papillae, some way in the back, right, the lingual tonsil? I guess you don't have to know. These are circumvallate papillae, right in this region right here. All right, but let's look at a papillae. So let's zoom into one of these projections coming off. All right, and I can see some cells. I see a cell right here and right here. Right, and I can see some cells over here. Now, if we can see cells, what kind of instrument do we need? A microscope. That's right. So these are what we call taste buds. Each one of these little things is a taste bud. So I guess you got to answer my first question. When you stick your tongue out and go, can you actually see your taste buds? The answer now you should see is no. What you can see are what? These papillae. And lining all of the papillae are all of these taste buds, right? So taste buds are microscopic. They're made up of a group of cells, but not a huge group, and you certainly cannot see them with your naked eye. This is what a taste bud really looks like. So here is a gustatory nerve. Taste fiber is going to the gustatory center in the brain. Here is the surface of a papillae, and notice that here is a little pore that saliva can move in and out of, a fluid can move in and out of here. And if there's taste molecules in that saliva, they can bind to receptors on these cells, right? And these are what we call gustatory cells, or maybe a hair cell, because they have these projections sticking off of them with receptors for various taste molecules, right? When a molecule binds to a receptor, that changes the electrical properties of this taste cell, which then sends electrical information to the brain. All right, so here's a nice micrograph of what a taste bud looks like. All right, so a taste bud definitely is microscopic. So here are the nerves that carry the taste sensations to the brain, to the medulla oblongata. And then here is that relay station. What's the relay station for sensory information? It has to stop here before it goes to the cerebral cortex. That's the thalamus. Yeah, that's one of the most important jobs of the thalamus. It's a relay station. All right? And then this goes to the taste center in the brain, someplace pretty close to the parietal and temporal lobe. Sometimes we call that the insula region. Okay, so we see we need 1, 2, 3 nerves to carry taste sensations to the cerebral cortex, and that's where you have the sensation of taste, or the appreciation of taste in your mind. Taste buds, composed of basal cells, support cells, gustatory receptor cells. Okay, and there are basically 5 primary taste sensations, and depending on which one of those taste sensations or combination of those taste sensations, then a lot of times you can actually diagnose or understand what kind of material it is that's on your tongue. And some of these sensations, the primary sensations, are sweet, sour, bitter, salty, and this one right here, which is this, gives you the sense of fulfillment or the sense of that you're eating something that's good for your body, that's called umami. And sometimes amino acids will stimulate this kind of receptor. What the heck is, what's the purpose of an amino acid? What good is it to have amino acids in your body or in your diet? They're a building block of proteins, one of the major components in your body, proteins. And so in order for your body to make a protein, it has to have amino acids. All right, so there are special receptors for sweet, different special receptors for sour, a different one for bitter, different one for salty, and another one for umami. And in physiology, we talk about some of these receptors. They're pretty cool, the way they work. I just want you to know that there are 5 of these. And has anybody ever tasted anything that was a little bit sweet and sour and salty all at the same time? Who could give me an example? That if somebody were to give that to me, I could taste the salt and the sweet, right? And the sour, and I would know what it was. Sweet and sour sauce, that's pretty good. It would be sweet, sour, okay? I'm not so sure about salty, though. Of course, there's salt in everything. Yeah, this is the United States, that's right. You can't eat anything without a lot of salt in it, okay, unfortunately, because that hurts a lot of people. How about a margarita? Have you ever, you guys don't drink, probably never had a margarita. That's why you didn't really know. Oh, you always have one unsalted, okay? But for instance, a margarita, Google that, find out what that is. I don't recommend that you go and order one, okay? But can you imagine what the components would be like? Okay. So that's the gustatory sense. We used to think that certain areas on the tongue were more responsible for some sensations than others. Like we used to think that sweet was at the tip and bitter was on the back over here. And now that theory has been debunked, right? We have the taste sensation pretty much all over our tongue. And some people might be more sensitive to other kind of tastes. And, you know, I think that's just a cultural thing. It's just how we grow up, how we appreciate, right, how our normal food should taste. Okay, so that's the sense of gustation. The next sense is olfaction. And olfaction is the sense of smell. Right? And so where's the only one place where you can smell? And that is your nose, indeed. All right, so again, just like for tasted molecules, we can sense odorant molecules if they bind to receptors. Right? So these odorant molecules have to enter, right, the nose and go up to the roof of the nasal cavity. Ooh, what color is that?
Red.
Okay, red's not good. All right, go up to the roof of the nasal cavity, and there you have some nerves that actually move right through the cranium, right, the bones that help make hold your brain, right, into the nasal cavity. And those are olfactory nerves. Right above those olfactory nerves is an enlargement that we call the olfactory bulb. So let's zoom into this region. So here we have a region, and can anybody remember the name of that bone right smack in the middle, right above your nasal cavity? It's part of it's part of the cranium. It helps hold your brain in place. It is the ethmoid bone, right? And these horizontal plates of the ethmoid bone is what we call what? The cribriform plate. Anybody remember what the name of all those holes are in the cribriform plate? Yeah, the olfactory foramina. Let's see how this goes. Hold your ears in case it explodes or something. Not turning on. Which means what? I put the batteries in backwards, probably. Okay. So the cribriform plate and the ethmoid bone have all those olfactory foramina, and there are nerves that pass through that cribriform plate. Okay, I'll try it again. Nice. Sounds terrible? No, sounds good. Okay. So here's the cribriform plate of the ethmoid bone, olfactory foramina, right? And then here we have axons of these receptor cells. And so here is that neuron. Can anybody remember what the shape of this neuron is? What do we call a neuron by this particular shape? I think that might be on the next test, right? You have to know neurons by shape. So what is this right here? Here's the cell body. And then there are two long processes on opposite sides of the cell body. So this, indeed, this is a bipolar neuron. What did we say that the function of a bipolar neuron was? Yeah, it was sensory. Do you agree with that? Yeah, for sure. Here's a really nice example. Okay. And then here you can see some olfactory cilia that are actually poking down through this epithelium into your nasal cavity. It's protected by a little bit of mucus, but a lot of things can penetrate mucus, right? So this is really the only place in your body that I know of where there are nerves actually dangling outside your body. Most are contained within. And since they're outside your body and exposed to whatever you're breathing in, they can be damaged really easily. Right, so they have a really hard lifetime because they're just exposed to whatever in the environment. Fortunately, we don't always lose our sense of smell because there are stem cells in this epithelium as well. Okay, and here is a stem cell here and here and here. And they're labeled basal cells. And what a stem cell is that it's a kind of cell that can turn into other kinds of cells. Right? And so these stem cells actually can turn into bipolar neurons and replace the ones that die. Right? And I find that pretty fascinating because what do you know about damage, for instance, to your spinal cord? Does it heal? No, right? So it's kind of a special trick when you have a neuron that can, right, or some neurons that can be replaced with other neurons. Right? But the stem cells in your nasal epithelium or olfactory epithelium can actually do that. And I used to joke, gee whiz, it'd be good to take some of these stem cells from this olfactory epithelium and transplant them into somebody's spinal cord so that they might be able to get over spinal cord injury because they can differentiate into neurons. And what might be one problem with that if you put some of these cells into somebody's back, their spinal cord? Well, then they might start smelling with their back. Okay, maybe, I don't know, that's kind of silly to say that. But after I've been making all of these jokes to impress upon you how important these stem cells are, somebody actually did give me a reference where somebody tried that last year. I don't know what the outcome is, but that would be great, right, if we can replace damaged nerves with some of these stem cells from somebody's nose. That would be super. Okay, olfaction has thousands of different kind of receptors. All right, what about for gustation? How many primary receptors are there? Yeah, there's just five. Right? But there's thousands and thousands for the sense of olfaction. Here I give you a couple, but this list is really, really short. Flowery is one, etheric is one, musky, camphorous, sweaty, rotten, stinging. These are all primary smell sensations. And that's why the sense of smell is so important, maybe not so much for humans anymore, but other animals can find their way around their environment by monitoring all of these thousands of different kinds of chemicals that are in the air. But nonetheless, all of these chemicals have to be able to evaporate in the air, and then they have to enter the nasal cavity and bind to these olfactory receptors in these bipolar neurons. So if there's an odorant molecule on the desk over there and I'm over here, there's no way I can perceive that molecule over there, right? Those molecules have to come to me or I got to come to them. There's no sensation at a distance. Okay, so I think that's pretty much just what I want to say. The most important thing are these basal cells, these bipolar cells, okay, and this olfactory bulb. You're going to see olfactory bulb this week in lab. And then here is the first sensory neuron that sends information to the brain. And these are all myelinated axons. So what do we call a myelinated axon in the brain? This is the olfactory bulb is actually part of your brain. that is a tract, right? Myelinated axons going someplace in the central nervous system is a tract. All right, so that is olfaction and gustation. Let's go on to vision. Is vision a special sense? Oh, indeed it is. All right, so what do we want to see about vision? So here is a nice illustration of an eye and a picture of an eye. Eyelids are called palpebrae, and in particular, oh, it's labeled eyelid right here. My goodness, I crossed that off and put palpebra. So here, which one is this? Which palpebra is this one right here? This is the superior, right? And then which one is this down over here? The inferior, fantastic. All right, so here are the angles, lateral angle, right? Medial angle of the eye, just like we had angles of the mouth as well. All right, on the palpebra we have eyelashes. All right, what do you think the job of the palpebra and the eyelashes are? Yeah, protection, right? So if there's a foreign object that touches these eyelashes, right, then what happens? Then you blink automatically, and that protects this outer part of the eye. This is what we call the cornea of the eye from all of that debris. And the same thing for these eyebrows. Again, that's for protecting the eye. Something brushes up against them that will start a blinking reflex. So these structures that are important for your eye but are not directly responsible for detecting light, these are what we call accessory structures. All right, so here's a list of accessory structures. Eyebrows, eyelids, which we call palpebrae. All right, there's a mucous membrane that covers the surface of the eye and the inner surface of the eyelid. All right, if we look at the illustration here, I can see the conjunctiva. The part of the conjunctiva that is on the eye itself, right, we call that the bulbar conjunctiva. And the part that lines the eyelid itself is what we call the palpebral conjunctiva. And, of course, that can be infected. Anybody know the name of that really infectious disease that can infect the conjunctiva? Okay, I forget the scientific name of the beast that does that, but it is, well, it's conjunctivitis, okay? Or pink eye, when somebody's eye turns really red and inflamed. In the eyelid, okay, I can see a gland, and these are the tarsal glands. Tarsal glands secrete mostly an oily kind of substance, and oil is a nice permeability barrier. It keeps the eyeball from drying out, right? But those oils are different from tears. Tears are produced by another accessory structure called a lacrimal gland, and I don't see it on this particular illustration. Maybe on the next one. Okay, all right, so here is midline, right over somebody's nose, and then moving off to the side or laterally, and the lateral aspect of the orbit and superior is a gland. This is the lacrimal gland that produces tears. And of course, that keeps the eye nice and moist, keeps it from drying out, just like those tarsal glands. And notice that the lacrimal gland is above the eye so that there's a natural flow pattern of tears. Right, over the from the top to the bottom and then over toward the middle of the eye, and there is a canaliculus, just a really small canal which takes tears into the lacrimal sac, which then drains into the nasolacrimal duct, and then that empties into the nose. I've never seen that in anybody. I should probably look sometime. I've never seen this little orifice of the nasolacrimal duct. So for instance, if you're crying sometime, right, not only are tears running down your face, where else are they running? Gross. Yeah, right out of your nose, okay, because of that nasolacrimal duct. This material in the medial angle of the eye is called a caruncle. It's not labeled on this slide. Maybe on the next one. It's not labeled. You probably don't have to know that. Is it on your list over here? No. You don't have to know that. Okay, some other accessory structures. So even if your head, keep your head facing straight ahead, can you look at something to the side? Okay, you can move your eyeball to the right, to the left, right, up and down. And that's because there are some muscles attached to the globe. And so are these muscles right here that are attached to the outer layer of the eye, are these smooth muscle or cardiac muscle or skeletal muscle? Skeletal muscle. Well, usually skeletal muscle is attached to your skeleton. So could this be skeletal muscle? And how could you convince me this is skeletal muscle? Because you have voluntary control of it. That's right. So even though it's not attached to the bone on this end, right, it is still nonetheless skeletal muscle. And there are six of them. Here is one. And this is going to be pretty much underneath the lacrimal gland. Where was that lacrimal gland, medial or lateral? Lateral, yeah. So here is the lateral rectus. Remember, rectus just means straight. There is a medial rectus, and then there's a superior and inferior rectus as well. All right, so you got four rectus muscles, and there are six altogether. The others come in at an angle. Here's one that's coming in on an angle, and then there's one down over. Oh, here's another one coming in on an angle to the eye. It helps rotate the eye a little bit. All right, and so these are what we call something that's angulated with reference to the normal straight planes in the body. Oblique, right? So here's a superior oblique and inferior oblique. Here's a nice anterior view of those muscles. And lateral, here's the medial. Right? So what's going to be, if only the medial rectus, all right, contracts, which way is this eyeball going to move? And all of these others kind of contract a little bit, so you can't rotate, you can't look up or down. All right, only the medial rectus contracts. What's going to happen to that eyeball? Yeah, it's going to move laterally. Okay, what do we call that when it moves laterally? Like here's your arm. My arm is moving up and out laterally. My hand is moving laterally. That is abduction. And then when I bring my arms back down to the side, what's that? Adduction. All right, so what do you think this medial rectus does? Medial, when that contracts, it pulls, it moves your eyeball medially, so that is, what motion is that? That is adduction, and you have to know a bunch of cranial nerves. Which one of those cranial nerves do you think adducts the eye? Now, only on one side of your face at the same time, okay? Oculomotor sounds really good. I kind of like that, but there's a better choice even. Is it on this list right here? So you know your cranial nerves for next week, right? So on Olympusine Towering Top, A. What's that A? Abducens. What does abducens mean? Okay, it abducts. So here is the abducens is the nerve, that does what? Abducts, right? So that affects the lateral rectus muscle that causes abduction of the eye. All right, so some of these cranial nerves actually make sense as to what their particular name is. And that's what? That's cranial nerve number 6. All right, goes to the lateral rectus for abduction. All right, so those are all still, what, accessory structures. So let's start talking about the eye in particular right now. So here is a really good exam figure. If we take an eye, and we're going to do this in lab, and we're not going to make this kind of cut on it. We're going to make a different kind of dissection on the eye. But if we were to take a whole eyeball and cut it in half, from the middle, so that this is a nice transverse section. So we're looking down from above into the eye. So it's not a sagittal section, but this is a nice transverse section. Let's talk about layers of the eye first to get that out of the way. The outermost layer is really, really tough, almost impossible to damage. It gives the shape, it gives the eye its overall shape and length and protects the eye. This is what we call the sclera. And so that's a superficial layer, super, super tough. And it's white, tougher than shoe leather. The next layer underneath it, I see a bunch of blood vessels. This is what we call the choroid. This is what brings nourishment into the eye, right? And it should be red-colored or very, very dark. There's also some pigments in there to absorb light so that light doesn't bounce around or flash around inside your eyeball. And then the third or deepest layer is the retina. That's a really delicate layer. And the retina contains photoreceptor cells. For what sense? For vision, right? So this is the layer that allows you to see because there are photoreceptor cells. And did I tell you what kind of? Yeah, you have to know the two different kinds of photoreceptor cells. There are rods and cones, right? Cones are really nice because they allow you to see in color. They give you color vision. They're also kind of small, so that means that they allow you to see fine detail. Another way of saying fine detail is high resolution. So you can detect edges of things, shapes of things very nicely with the cone cells. They are located in the center of your visual field, which is really close to this dot that I see. This is the retina, it's on the retina. When light comes in the eye, those extrinsic eye muscles position the eyeball so that light, right, shines straight back to this area right here. Right? And if you're going to want to look at something over here and light comes in and bounces over here, then those extrinsic eye muscles are going to turn the eyeball so that light is going to fall on this area. So this is the area that's, well, the fovea centralis, right, only has cone cells. And there is one downside to a cone cell. It only works in bright light. Right? So central vision are cone cells, color, fine detail, but bright light. In dim light, you can't perceive anything. It's like having a blind spot in your eye. Right? Fovea centralis has another region that we call the macula lutea that's almost as good as the fovea centralis, but now you start to have some rod cells in this area as well. And as you move away from the fovea centralis in any direction, then the distribution of rod cells and cone cells changes. The farther you get away from fovea centralis, the more rod cells you have and the less cone cells. So in the periphery, in these regions far away from the fovea centralis, you only have rod cells. Rod cells are not good for fine detail and you can't see color. But why do you think we have rod cells? What's the good of a photoreceptor cell where you can't see fine detail and color? Okay, you see black and white, all right, but what good is that? There's something special about these cells, something that gives you an advantage. They work in dim light. That's their deal, right? Cones only bright light, rod cells in dim light, but they're not quite as good. They don't give you as perfect a vision, right? But it's dim light, so that certainly helps. Maybe go outside sometime when there's no clouds and pretty clear and you can see some stars in the sky, right? Try to find a star and then look right at it. And sometimes it just disappears. And then if you look off to the side, it reappears. And that's because when you're looking right at it, that light from the star is going only to those cones and it might not be bright enough for you to see. But if you turn your eyeball so that light is going to your peripheral vision where those rods are, right, then that star will just pop right where it should be. Okay? But of course you'll only be able to tell that it's white. It won't have any color information. Some stars are so bright you can actually use some cone cells in your central vision to detect some slight color that's associated with them. Okay, but the ones that disappear when you look right at them, okay, you'll only be able to tell that it's white. All right, so who can name those three layers? I got carried away. What are the three layers? Sclera, I like. The choroid and the retina. Oh, I got to digress just a little bit as well. Okay, when I look at the retina, right where I have the cursor, do you see any blood vessels? No blood vessels. That's important because if there was a blood vessel there, then you couldn't have a photoreceptor cell, couldn't have a rod or a cone. And if you don't have a rod and cone, what else are you missing? Vision. So you would have a blind spot. So these blood vessels should stay in the choroid. They shouldn't grow into the retina. And because that will produce vision deficits or blindness. And if there's a lot of growth, then that blindness can be really severe. Right? And that happens sometimes, or used to happen sometimes, for premature babies. What do we do with a baby that's not completely developed and formed by the time they're born? Cesarean section, probably. Where are they placed so that they can survive? Yeah, they're given high oxygen. Right in an incubation chamber, right, and it's regulated. The temperature is regulated, oxygen, because their lungs aren't really developed, so they need a higher oxygen concentration that they're breathing, so oxygen can get into their body. Well, that oxygen will diffuse into this posterior part of the eye, right, and into the retina, and these blood vessels sense that there is high oxygen in the retina, and then they start to grow into the retina, and later on in life. Right, it was discovered that people were growing up blind and that's because they were put in an incubation chamber that had a too high oxygen concentration that stimulated growth into the retina. That's called retinopathy, right? That's damage to the retina of prematurity, retinopathy of prematurity. So now, when we put an infant or a newborn or somebody that's not completely to term into an incubation chamber, what does a physician have to consider? Oxygen. Enough oxygen, right, to compensate for the underdeveloped lungs, but not so much that you actually cause development of blood vessels into the retina, right? So that's a tough judgment call, I'm sure, sometimes. All right, so those are the layers and the significance of all those different layers. So here is the sclera, and it's moving to the anterior part of the eye, so we're going to call this the anterior pole, and the eye now changes, or this layer changes. Instead of being really tough and white, it becomes relatively delicate and completely clear. And that's what we call the cornea. Right? And is that cornea nice and flat? What can you tell me about the shape of that cornea? Is it flat looking? No, it's what? How would you describe that? Wrinkled up? Convolutions? It is? I would just say it's curved. Right, the cornea has a certain curvature to it. Right, all right. So that's the cornea, and then, all right, light goes through the cornea. It's got to pass through this foramen. The foramen is right in the middle of the iris. The iris is a muscle that can relax and contract. It changes the diameter of that hole or foramen, and that hole is what we call the pupil. Right, so the pupil is a foramen, and it lets light enter the interior spaces of the eye. Right, and then here is the lens. And what can you tell me about the surface of this lens right here? And the surface over here. Is it straight and flat? No, it is. It's also curved. Right, so if you look at the curve of a lens, and we agree that there is a curvature to the cornea, well, the lens helps focus light. Can you imagine that the cornea helps focus light? Because it has the shape of a lens. And as a matter of fact, the cornea is the most important focusing element in your eye. Right? So that really helps focus so that light is focused by the time it gets to the retina. Right? The lens is important, but not because of its overall power and strength, but because it can do something special. And although I turn the lights down in here, I want to do an experiment on each of you. Right? So take your hand and stretch out your hand as far as you can in front of you, okay? And look at your fingertips. Clearly look at your fingertips. What can you tell me about the background? Your fingertips are in focus, but what about the background?
Blurry.
It's blurry. Those of you in the front row might have trouble seeing that. You can turn around and look at somebody in the back. All right, so look at your fingertips. Focus on them. They're clear. Background is blurry. Now look at the background. Forget your fingertips are there. Get the background in focus. What can you tell me about your fingertips? Now they're blurry. I actually see like 20 of them right there. Oh, now I see two. Okay, now, oh, there's 20 again. Oh yeah, but nonetheless, it's blurry. All right, so you can only focus at one distance, all right, from your eye. And what allows you to change that distance is this lens. It has to change shape. All right, so how does your body usually accomplish shape changes with gross structures like this? What has to be attached to it? Muscle, right? There's got to be a muscle. So here is the muscle that attaches to it. It's posterior to the iris. This is what we call the ciliary body or ciliary muscle. Same thing. All right, and that's a smooth muscle, just like the iris is smooth muscle. You don't have control over it. And the things that connect the ciliary body to the lens are what we call suspensory ligaments. Suspensory ligaments. You're going to see these things in lab. So you got lens, suspensory ligaments, ciliary body. Change the shape of the lens so that you can see things either close up or far away, but not both at the same time. That's a special ability that we call accommodation. All right, so, and do I have this on the list over here? Yeah, accommodation, if you want to know how to spell it. I think that's spelled correctly. All right, accommodation means that the lens has to change shape because light is coming in at different angles depending on whether it's far away or close to your eye, and so we have to, right, change the shape of our lens to see things that way. All right. And of course, as we get older, then this lens gets stiffer and stiffer and stiffer to where it doesn't want to change very much anymore, or it takes a longer time So let me give you a quick example. Let's just say we have like a 75-year-old person driving on the freeway. What can you tell me about, how is that person driving? Slow. Everybody said slow. They're driving slow. Exactly right. Okay. Now, why are they driving slow? Because, number one, they don't want to get a ticket for speeding, right? Because if they get a ticket, then they're going to lose their license. And then the other thing is they don't want to miss their exit on the freeway, because if they miss their exit, then they got to stay on the freeway, which is scary, right? And you might get a ticket. All right, so how is it that you're not speeding? How can you tell how fast you're going? What do you use? You guys speed all the time or what? No, you look at the speedometer. Where's the speedometer? Right in the dashboard, close to your eyes, right? So you look at the speedometer that's close, and you go, oh, good, I'm only going 35 miles an hour. I'm not going to get a ticket. And then what's the next thing that person thinks of? Oh, my God, where is my exit? Because I don't want to miss my exit. So they look up from the speedometer and look out the windshield, and guess what they see? Blur. Everything's blurry because they can't accommodate very fast. All right, and so 1001, 1002, all of a sudden their vision pops into focus, and they see their exit is way down on the freeway yet. They didn't miss it. All right. Well, what's the next thing that they're worried about? Am I speeding now? Because I haven't looked at the speedometer. So they look away from the road down at the speedometer, and what do they see? Blurry. It's all blurry, right? 1001, 1002, and all of a sudden the speedometer pops into focus. They go, oh, good, I'm doing 36 miles an hour. I won't get a ticket. Now what are they thinking about? As soon as they're sure they're not going to get a ticket. They don't want to miss their exit. So they look out the windshield again. What do they see? Blurriness, right, until they can accommodate, because it takes time for this lens to shift. All right, so when you see somebody driving like that, just stay away from them. Be very polite. Sometimes it's hard to imagine why somebody would drive so slow, but be polite to all those viejitos out there, because they just can't see as well as all of us younger people. Okay, so what sense is that? That's called accommodation, right? Accommodation. Okay, well, these photoreceptor cells send information to the optic nerve. Here's a nice optic nerve, right? Cranial nerve number 2. This is where the optic nerve attaches to the retina. This is called the optic disc. And if there's a nerve right here, there can't be any photoreceptor cells. So what's another name for the optic disc? It's called the blind spot, because you can't see anything. You have a blind spot in each eye, and if you were to look around the room right now trying to find your blind spot, you can't see it, because you're so used to not knowing that it's there. Your mind just fills it in with what information your brain thinks should be there, and it's really hard to notice. In lab, I could actually demonstrate that blind spot to you by putting a diagram on the board. I forgot to do that in this morning's lab. All right, you'll be looking at something and you position your head a certain way, and all of a sudden it just disappears. You can't really tell what's there. It kind of looks like a whiteboard, right? And then if you look away from it, then you see it again. Okay? And that's because that light was going into the blind spot. All right, so fovea centralis, best vision. Macula lutea, very good vision, surrounds the fovea centralis. So what kind of cells are in the macula lutea and fovea centralis? Cone cells, right? Need bright light. Have you ever heard of a condition called macular degeneration? It's a disease of the eye, disease process of the eye, to where the macula lutea and fovea centralis start to degrade, and those cells are destroyed. So what part of your vision then goes away because those photoreceptor cells are gone? The very center part of your vision. So take your fingertip, but don't poke yourself in the eye. Take your fingertips and put them right in front of your eye. All right, so what do you see? I see blur in the center, but I can still see in peripheral vision. All right, so somebody with macular degeneration, if they want to see something, how do they have to look? Off to the side, and then they got to figure out how to make sense of that information. Right, that's kind of sad when that happens. Sometimes that's an autoimmune response. A person's own body develops antibodies that attack the cells just in this one region of the retina. Okay. Some chambers of the eye. Okay. The way that we break up the chambers of the eye is look at the ciliary body, suspensory ligaments, and lens. This forms a plane through the eye, at least an imaginary plane through the eye. And there are chambers anterior to it and a chamber posterior to it, and these are filled with fluids. In this chamber over here, this posterior segment, so this cavity right here is called the posterior segment. You'll see why it's called a segment in just a second. Contains a fluid that's like a jelly. All right, and it's really viscous. It doesn't run. And we call that vitreous humor, right? Or viscous humor. It's highly viscous. And you'll see that in lab. It's like a jelly material. The fluid that is anterior to the lens is more like water. And we call that aqueous humor, right? Vitreous humor can't run anywhere. But aqueous humor, you think that can run anywhere since it's just like water? Yeah, water runs just fine, right? So aqueous humor can actually flow very nicely from where it is produced in some areas very close to this ciliary body, and it flows out the pupil into this chamber that is anterior to the iris, and then it gets drained by this venous sinus right here, the scleral venous sinus. So there's a certain kind of flow pattern. All right, so here is aqueous humor. So here in front of the iris has aqueous humor. We're going to call this the anterior segment. Right? And then behind the iris, we're going to call this the posterior segment of the anterior part of the anterior cavity of the eye. Right? And so here's the posterior segment behind the lens and vitreous humor. Okay, I think that's all I want to say about that. Well, I got to say something else. It's really important. All right, so we said that the sclera is what? Tough or delicate? It's really tough. What about the cornea? It's a continuation of the sclera, but it is? Yeah, it's very delicate, right? And that's because it's clear to allow light in. So, since it's very delicate, is it easy to damage or hard to damage? It's really easy to damage, right? Any kind of high-speed or relatively high-speed objects, if they touch the cornea, can rip the cornea. And there are pain receptors in the cornea. If they are stimulated, I have been told that that will give you the most exquisite sense of pain that you can experience. So you don't ever want to damage your cornea. But you know what? That exquisite sense of pain is nothing compared to what actually could happen. All right, you want to hear what's really bad that could happen? All right, remember, what kind of fluid is in this area here? Aqueous humor, right? When the cornea is perforated, that aqueous humor can dribble right out of the eye, right? Because it just runs just like water. So now you don't have that fluid in these different spaces, and the cornea can touch the lens, and the cornea can touch the iris can touch the lens. All right, so what, and then here is the really bad thing. No one has ever figured out a way how to unstick these different parts of the eye once they touch each other. So the iris is glued to the lens. The cornea is glued to the iris, and the cornea could even be glued to the lens over here as well. Right? And so that distorts the shape of the cornea. What does that do? Okay, it destroys your vision because the cornea has to have the proper curvature to it for you to see correctly. Right? Now, and since the iris is glued to the cornea or to the lens, right? Why is that so bad? Because all day long, what is this iris doing? Yeah, it's moving around, it's changing shape. But if it's glued to something, guess what? It can't change shape anymore. All right? And what is this lens doing all day long? Is it just sitting there, or is it? It's changing shape all day long as well. So if it's glued to something, then it can't work properly either. All right? So somebody's vision is almost completely destroyed, right, if that ever happens. So that's why it's really important to wear eye protection. When you're working with chemicals, or even if you're working on your bicycle or car, motorcycle, or even putting together a swing set for your kids in the backyard in case some piece of metal breaks off, right, and hits the cornea right here, that could be it for this particular eye. All right, so that would be a terrible thing. Okay, I had to mention that. All right, one last thing. The cornea has to have a proper curvature to it. Right? And in some people, the curvature of the cornea is too much compared to the length of the eyeball. So that light focuses way behind it. And so there's a really nice procedure that can change the shape of the cornea for you. Anybody know what that procedure is called? Yeah, it's called the LASIK procedure. LASIK procedure is when somebody takes a laser and blasts away a few of these cells on the cornea, and it changes the shape of the cornea so that now light focuses exactly on the retina, and that can give you perfect vision, or maybe even better than 20/20 vision. And I don't know if I recommend that procedure for cosmetic reasons, because things can go wrong, and any kind of procedure, if it goes wrong, then that's going to disrupt a very important sense for you. The other thing is that the shape of your eyeball is going to change throughout your lifetime, or it does at least in a lot of people. LASIK is good only for that one particular time in your life. And one last thing. As we get older, right, what do most people, as they age, what do they start to need? Maybe around age 50, 55? Reading glasses. That's right, because this lens right here just gets too stiff. Okay. And the better your vision is for far, then the worse your vision is for reading. That's just the way the physics of lenses work. All right, so when somebody gets a LASIK procedure, their far vision is perfect, but what are they giving away when they have that done? Their near vision, right? So their eyes now behave as if it's a really old eye. So with a LASIK procedure, you won't need glasses to see far away, but you might automatically need glasses to read. I've known a couple people to get a LASIK procedure, and you can see perfectly almost right away. Walk outside, everything's beautiful and perfect, just really ecstatic, and then they get a phone call on their cell phone. And guess what? They don't know how to use their cell phone because they can't see it anymore. So if you get a procedure like this, make sure you get a reputable physician and a good consultation to know what the trade-offs are. There's always trade-offs in everything. All right? But I recommend it, for instance, for people whose vision is so poor you can't even find your glasses in the morning. All right? Who can't find their glasses in the morning because your vision is so poor? Nobody. I guess you've had LASIK procedure already. Okay, then go ahead and have LASIK procedure. Or if you're a professional athlete, right, you don't want to wear glasses if somebody's going to smack you in the face, right? So in that condition is probably pretty good. All right, so for vision, you need to have the proper shape of the cornea and proper shape of the lens. They have to work together, and I think that's why I have this little asterisk right here, okay, for the lens and the cornea. They work together. Okay, I think you can read up on these tunics of the eye. They're just made up of these different layers, right, just a different organization of these different layers, visual pathways. I talked about all of this already. Oh, what's this condition right here? When the lens starts to become opaque and your vision starts to look really cloudy. Cataracts, yeah, cataracts. Okay, they used to be treated just by removing that cloudy lens. I think I want to put this away. What happened to it? Is that all I have? Okay, so here are these two eyeballs. And this is probably arranged really nice for colors. All right, so I see like a yellow area here and a blue area here. Can everybody kind of see what I'm talking about? Okay, so the yellow is what we say in your right visual field, and the blue is in your left visual field. And that blue light, right, can enter both eyes, right, even though it's from the left visual field. And so this blue light is going to come in right over here. This blue light is going to come in way over here on the other eye. And notice what happens, right? Some of this information, right, crosses over to the other side of the brain, right? So here's the optic nerve. Here's where some, and these are tracts, right, because these are myelinated axons. So this is the optic nerve coming in, which means that this, since it's a nerve, it's peripheral nervous system. Some of these fibers cross over, right, from both eyes. This is what we call the optic chiasma. You're going to see that in lab. It's just a nice X where they cross over. And so everything in the right visual field ends up in the left part of the occipital lobe. Everything that's in the left visual field, depending, doesn't matter what eye it is, right, comes to the right visual field in the occipital lobe. So these signals cross over. Okay, some of these signals go to, for instance, the superior colliculus that allows for you to track objects as they're moving in space. And we need one, okay, and then two neurons to get to the cortex in order for you to have perception of light. And so here is the relay station for this sensory information before it gets to the visual cortex. What is this relay station called? Here and here. Almost all sensory information has to go through these two areas in the brain that will direct it to the proper location in your cerebral cortex. And again, that is the thalamus. That's really good for you to know. All right, so the visual cortex is the occipital lobe. And for hearing, it's going to be the temporal lobe. So nerves coming in will go to the thalamus, and then the thalamus, if it's from your ear, will take it to the temporal lobe so that you can get the sensation of hearing. All right, well, let's talk about hearing. That's a pretty good illustration. Yep, good enough. All right, so here is the ear. We're familiar with the external ear, like the auricle that helps kind of funnel sound energy into this canal that goes inside your head. All right, this is what we call the external acoustic meatus. I think you're aware of that already. And this is what we call the external ear. It ends at the tympanic membrane. So here's a tympanic membrane. Once you get past the tympanic membrane, then you're in the middle ear. And I see that there are some bones in the middle ear. We call these auditory ossicles. How many bones can you see? I see three, right? The malleus, incus, and stapes. Notice the stapes kind of looks like a stirrup that somebody would put their foot into when riding a horse. And it contains only air, right? And what kind of materials in the external acoustic meatus? There's air in the middle ear. What about this external ear? Air, yeah, there's only air in there, so air on both sides of the tympanic membrane. When the tympanic membrane vibrates back and forth, then the auditory ossicles start to vibrate, including the stapes. The stapes is attached to another membrane, and it gets pulled back and forth. On the other side of this membrane, then we have the internal ear. So the ear's got these three major components: external, middle, and inner. Sometimes the inner ear we call the labyrinth because there's all kinds of special little chambers in there that we got to talk about. All right, so sound enters your external acoustic meatus, vibrates the tympanic membrane back and forth, goes through these auditory ossicles, vibrates something that we call a window, and we talk about it by the shape. Right? It's going to have the same shape as the footprint of the stapes. So what can you tell? How would we want to name this window right here? Square window? Triangle? Oval window. Fantastic. And that's its name, its correct anatomic name, right? Oval window. Sound enters the labyrinth, and then we got three major parts of the labyrinth. We got something that looks like a snail. We call that the cochlea. That is for hearing. Cochlea is for hearing. I see a special chamber right in this area. We call that the vestibule. Vestibule, right on the other side of the oval window, that's the vestibule. And that is important for linear acceleration or static equilibrium. And then you see some of these circle-like structures. There are three of them. I only see two on this illustration. These are what we call the semicircular canals. These will sense the third sense in the inner ear, and that is for what? Angular acceleration or dynamic equilibrium for spinning. All right, so those are the three senses. These are in the inner ear. Well, here I see a tube. It's called the pharyngotympanic tube. Here's the tympanic membrane. That's how it got its name. But so this tube connects the middle ear to the pharynx. Right, that's where this pharyngo comes from. Does anybody know what pharynx? We haven't talked about the pharynx in this class yet, but you'll be really familiar with it by the time the class is over. Anybody have a feeling for where your pharynx is? And it's got a common name. You're going to really love this. Your pharynx is your throat. Okay. So here's a tube that connects your throat to the middle ear. And if somebody has a sore throat, okay, it's an itis of some kind, What kind of inflammation, what kind of itis would we call that when somebody has a sore throat? What's another name for your throat?
Pharynx.
Pharynx, right? So that's what we call a pharyngitis. A sore throat is a pharyngitis. Maybe you've heard of that, and that's because your throat is your pharynx. All right, so what's the deal with this pharyngotympanic tube? Well, we said that the tympanic membrane has got to vibrate back and forth. And if pressure ever developed in the middle ear, it would push the tympanic membrane way out into the external acoustic meatus and hold it there. It couldn't vibrate. And if it can't vibrate, can you hear anything? No, you can't. Okay? Or if the pressure in the middle ear decreased so much, right, then the atmospheric pressure would push the tympanic membrane all the way into the middle ear and it couldn't vibrate. Again, what would happen? You can't hear anything, right? So this pharyngotympanic tube is just a way to equalize the pressure on either side of the tympanic membrane so that it can vibrate freely back and forth. I don't know, maybe you've been on an airplane or drove up into the mountains, and all of a sudden maybe you hear a little squeaking sound, or maybe you yawn, right? And then all of a sudden you can hear perfectly again. Well, what that did was just open up this pharyngotympanic tube, right? And it equalized the, or maybe you hold your nose and pressurize. Oh, my ears just squeaked. Okay, and so now you can hear really well once again. Okay, try that sometime and you'll see the beautiful purpose of this pharyngotympanic tube. Well, there is a malady that happens to really young people, 1-year-old, 2-year-old, 3-year-olds. Happens a lot, pretty common. And it affects ears. Ear infection, that's right, ear infections. And mostly these are of the middle ear right here. Does anybody know the scientific name for middle ear infection? Otitis, right, because this oto refers to the hearing ability. All right, otitis media. What chamber is infected? The middle one, right? Otitis media is when this one here gets inflamed. Maybe fluid builds up in this area, right? It blocks the pharyngotympanic tube, and since there's fluid in this area, maybe even pus or mucus sometimes, then these auditory ossicles can't vibrate, but that also prevents the tympanic membrane from moving, and it pushes it out. And maybe you've been on an airplane flight with a youngster who's really, really young, and they start screaming, right, when they're taking off or landing. Guess what's happening to them? They can't equalize their ears because of that inflammation in the middle ear. And as this tympanic membrane gets pushed one way or the other, it starts to hurt really, really bad. All right, so you see a little baby kid like that, really misbehaving, crying unconsolably, probably they have otitis media, or that could be one of the reasons. Maybe that could be treated, right, so they don't experience that pain. Talk to your pediatrician to make sure you get the proper drugs that can affect that, like anti-inflammatories or allergy medication or something like that. All right, so that is the middle ear. Let's go to the inner ear over here, which is the labyrinth. We got done talking about that middle ear. Here is the cochlea, here's the vestibule, and then the semicircular canals for these three senses. Okay, we're just going to talk about hearing first. Okay, so here is, so the labyrinth is made up of a bony labyrinth, right, that we call semicircular canals, vestibule, or cochlea. Inside that bony labyrinth is a membranous labyrinth. There are membranes that can actually help make various chambers. And we're going to talk about this cochlea right here first. Here is the stapes with the oval window. It's going to inject sound pressure waves into the vestibule, and then they're going to enter the cochlea and move around in the cochlea. And I want to describe how it moves around a little bit. Okay. So here is that cochlea. Normally it's all wound up, looks like a snail. And what's been done on this illustration? Here's the cochlea. Right, here's the oval window. Here's the cochlea, the membranous labyrinth on the inside. And it's just been unrolled so that it looks like just a straight line. All right, so why is it all rolled up inside your temporal bone? It's in the petrous region of the temporal bone. Why is that cochlea all rolled up like that? Well, it would work just fine if it was straight, but then it would be sticking outside your head. Right, and we all look kind of funny with our cochleas kind of pointing out of our heads like that. So evolution has figured out a way how to stick it inside your head by what? By folding it up or rolling it up like that. Okay. Let's look at, I want to come back to this. Let's see if we can name some of these chambers. Okay. So here is, if we take a cross section of the cochlea, we see that it's got 1, 2, 3 major chambers in it. The very center one contains the organ of Corti. Organ of Corti is the special organ that allows you to hear. All right, so what are these other things? The oval window is connected to the scala vestibuli, and it contains a fluid we call perilymph. Right? And then the chamber down below it is called the cochlear duct, and that contains the organ of Corti. And then the chamber down below it is called the scala tympani, and that one also contains perilymph. All right, so now let's go back to that one illustration. So here's the oval window connected to the scala vestibuli. Okay, here is the cochlear duct, and then here is the scala tympani. So sound energy enters the tympani, right, and it can go through the cochlear duct. And so that's a lot of energy. If that energy stays inside the cochlea, it's going to rupture something or damage a bunch of cells. So that pressure has to be released or reduced so that when it reaches the terminus of the scala tympani, there is another membrane right here called, and it looks round. So we call it the round window. And it vibrates back and forth. That prevents high pressure from building up in the cochlea. All right, oval window, sound in. Round window, sound out, or that pressure out. All right, now the shape of this cochlear duct changes. And things vibrate at a particular frequency, and it's determined by its shape. So when I look at this cochlea right here, I think of a piano. How is a piano arranged? On one side, you have like a high note, and then a low note right next to it, and then another high note, a medium note, and you have to figure out what key to play. But maybe you have all the A's over here, but a low A, medium A, and a really high A, and then another D's over here on the other side, you know, high frequency, low frequency, A, over on the other side. How's the piano laid out? Yeah, the frequencies go in a nice continuous fashion, right, from high frequency to low frequency, or the other way around, high frequency to low frequency, but there is a difference. Every key sounds very similar, but just slightly different frequency from one end to the other. All right, and so has anybody ever looked inside a piano? Why is it that when you strike a key on one side, it sounds different compared to when you strike a key on the other side? There's something special inside the piano that makes sure that happens. Yeah, the strings vibrate, and are the strings the same? They're different sizes, right? So just by the size of those strings will determine what kind of frequency it will produce. Very thin, short strings will produce a high frequency. Longer, fixed strings will vibrate at a lower frequency. That's why pianos usually have that funny kind of harp shape to them. Okay, the same thing for this cochlea. All right, the biggest part of the cochlea is over here. This is the longest part, actually the widest part. This is the part that will vibrate at low frequency, and this is the thinnest part over here. This is the part that will vibrate at what kind of frequency? High frequency. That's right. So when a complex sound comes in, right, it's broken up into various frequencies, like low over here and high over here, that sound will move across the cochlear duct into the scala tympani. When it does, it will stimulate that one region of the cochlear duct, and just the organ of Corti, just in this one region. All right, so when I look at a cochlea, I think of a musical instrument. What kind of musical instrument am I thinking of? It kind of looks like a piano, okay? And so then this part is going to send electrical information to the high frequency part of your auditory cortex, and cells over here are going to send nerve impulses to the low frequency part of your cerebral cortex, and that's in the temporal lobe. Oh, I don't want to close that. I don't think I have a picture of the temporal lobe. Oh, yeah, I do. Okay, so here's the temporal lobe. This is what we call the primary auditory cortex. And the primary auditory cortex is going to be arranged just like a piano as well. So if we stimulate cells over here, there'll be a high frequency, and if we go way out over here, then it will be a low frequency, corresponding to different parts from the cochlea. All right, let me go back to this diagram here. All right, so here is that top chamber, the vestibule. Here is the middle chamber, the cochlear duct. And then here's the bottom chamber. This is how sound leaves the organ of leaves the cochlea, so it doesn't get damaged. And so these all contain fluid. This thing will vibrate only at a particular frequency and is determined by the shape, right, of this thing. So what is this thing? Let's take a look. Let's zoom into this region. Okay. So up over here, we have the cochlear duct. Down over here, we have the scala tympani, both contained with fluid. What are some structures that I see? Here is the tectorial membrane, right? And it can flop around. It can vibrate with sound just like the tympanic membrane or oval window. Here are some cells. These are what we call hair cells. And I see some other hair cells over here. And they have some of these cilia projecting up and touching the tectorial membrane. So when the tectorial membrane starts to vibrate, then these hair cells can detect that vibration because the cilia bend. They bend one way or the other. And when they do, it changes the electrical properties of these receptor cells, these hair cells, which then can send signals into this nerve that takes it to the temporal lobe for hearing. All right, so then here is the basilar membrane, tectorial membrane, various support cells. This thing right here is what we call the organ of Corti, right, made up of the tectorial membrane, basement membrane, hair cells, and then some other support cells. So what is the receptor cell for hearing? The receptor cell for hearing are the hair cells. It sounds kind of funny. They don't have hairs, but they have these cilia that can bend. All right, so if a sound wave is going to move across this membrane from the cochlear, through the cochlear duct into the scala tympani, then right, these hair cells, the electrical properties of these hair cells will be disturbed, and that's going to send electrical, different kinds of electrical information to the brain. All right, so that's for hearing. Okay. Balance. Okay, we got two senses of balance. And where were these two senses at? The two senses were, I guess this is a good place to look. Okay, so here's that cochlea. I can see the membranous labyrinth inside the bony labyrinth. Then here is the vestibule. And then here are the semicircular canals. All right, for static equilibrium or linear acceleration, it is the vestibule that will do the job for us. And there are two receptor organs in the vestibule. Both of these things are called maculae. One is called the utricle and the other is called the saccule. So here's the utricle, here's the saccule. Right? And for angular acceleration or dynamic equilibrium, we use the semicircular canals. Here is a little bulge in the base of a semicircular canal. That's called an ampulla. Right, and the ampule is just a small little vial that you would put some kind of medication in for something, and that reminded, whoever looked at this reminded them of a little vial or ampule. That contains the receptor organs for spinning or for angular acceleration. These are what we call the crista ampullaris. They're located in the ampules. Right, and then there's fluid in all of these different chambers. So which one do we want to talk about first? Static equilibrium. Let's look at static equilibrium first. All right, so static equilibrium, are we going to be looking at the vestibule or the semicircular canals? Vestibule. Okay, indeed. Okay, so here's the utricle, here's the saccule within the vestibule. All right, the membranous labyrinth contains this structure right here. Well, notice I see some hair cells. Where did you, what sense also used hair cells? Hearing, right? Okay, so here are some hair cells. They're connected to this nerve that goes to the brain, right? And these cilia poke up into what we call a gelatinous mass. Here's something like gelatin, right? So gravity can deform this thing, kind of like vitreous humor a little bit. Now, what's sitting on top of the of this otolithic membrane or gelatinous mass? What do these all these things look like? These are crystals. Yeah, so I see some nice crystalline structure right here. These are what we call otoliths. Otoliths are combinations of the calcium carbonate. These act as little weights. So you do have crystals inside your ear for static equilibrium, and they press down on this gelatinous mass. If they're pushing straight down, the stereocilia don't bend. Right, so if somebody has their head looking straight forward, these otoliths push straight down, they don't bend the stereocilia on these hair cells. But as soon as you bend your head down, look at this gelatinous mass. It starts to sag a little bit because of all these weights on top of it. Now what happens to those cilia? They start to bend, right? And as they start to bend, they will send electrical information to the brain. And if you bend your head the other way, then it will reduce the information sent to your brain, and your brain will have then a sense of acceleration. And that's because gravity sort of acts as acceleration, but I can't really get into the physics of that very much. All right, but let's just look at this right here. Okay, if this person that's standing still all of a sudden starts to move, right, maybe you can get the idea, right, if they start to accelerate, then the stereocilia are going to get bent to the back. Right. And when if they're moving at a high speed and then this person stops, then these stereocilia are going to be bent to the forward location because that's the way this gelatinous mass is going to move. So gravity is a lot like acceleration. Right. So you can get a sense of body position, right, just by changing the angulation with your eyes closed of your head. Okay, that's the job of the utricle and saccule. Kinetic equilibrium due to these semicircular canals. Okay, and so here is the ampule, and here is another gelatinous mass. We call this the cupula, and then here's a hair cell. And guess what's sticking up into this into the cupula? Some of those cilia. Sometimes we call these stereocilia. And depending on how this cupula bends one way or the other, you will get a sense of spinning. And I got a demonstration to do, but I have to do that next time because we're out of time. But check that out in your textbook and sign the sign-in sheet, please.